Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, information, commentary, and history about the African American community. This week, in recognition of the Martin Luther King holiday, I have five selections about Dr. King from The Independent Newspaper, Nonprofit Quarterly Magazine, the website mentalfloss.com. I'm going to end the program with an excerpt from the biography King: A Life, and I'm starting with this. Trump administration releases FBI records on Martin Luther King Jr. despite his family's opposition. This was written by Bill Barrow and published July 21, 2025. The Trump administration on Monday, July 21, 2025, released records of the FBI surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. despite opposition from the slain Nobel laureate's family and the civil rights group that he led until his 1968 assassination. The digital document dump includes more than 240,000 pages of records that had been under a court-imposed seal since 1977, when the FBI first gathered the records and turned them over to the National Archives and Records Administration. In a lengthy statement, the King's two living children, Martin III, 67, and Bernice, 62, said their father's killing has been a captivating public curiosity for decades. But the pair emphasized the personal nature of the matter and urged that the files be viewed within their full historical context. The Kings got advance access to the records and had their own teams reviewing them. Those efforts continued even as the government granted public access. Among the documents are leads the FBI received after King's assassination and details of the CIA's fixation on King's pivot to international anti-war and anti-poverty movements in the years before he was killed. It was not immediately clear whether the documents shed new light on King's life, the civil rights movement, or his murder. As the children of Dr. King and Mrs. Coretta Scott King, his tragic death has been an intensely personal grief, a devastating loss for his wife, children, and the granddaughter he never met. An absence our family has endured for over 57 years, they wrote. We ask those who engage with the release of these files to do so with empathy, restraint, and respect for our family's continuing grief. They also repeated the family's long-held contention that James Earl Ray, the man convicted of assassinating King, was not solely responsible, if at all. Bernice King was 5 years old when her father was killed at the age of 39. Martin III was 10. A statement from the Office of Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, called the disclosure unprecedented and said many of the records had been digitized for the first time. She praised President Donald Trump for pushing the issue. Trump promised as a candidate to release files related to President John F. Kennedy's 1963 assassination. When Trump took office in January 2025, he signed an executive order to declassify the John F. Kennedy records, along with those associated with Robert F. Kennedy's and Martin Luther King's 1968 assassinations. The government unsealed the JFK records in March 2025 and disclosed some RFK files in April of that year. That was the Associated Press article titled, "Trump Administration Releases FBI Records on Martin Luther King Jr. Despite His Family's Opposition." This was written by Bill Barrow and published July 21st, 2025. My next reading is titled, 12 Historic Facts About Martin Luther King Jr. This was written by Jake Rosin and published January 2, 2026 at the website mentalfloss.com. Martin Luther King Jr., the Atlanta native who became one of the most important figures in the civil rights movement, was born on January 15, 1929. While it would be impossible to encompass everything King accomplished in a mere list, we've compiled a few intriguing facts that might pique your interest in finding out more about the man who helped unite a divided nation. One of the most recognizable proper names of the 20th century wasn't actually what was on the birth certificate. The future civil rights leader was born Michael King Jr. on January 15, 1929, named after his father, Michael King. When the younger King was 5 years old, his father decided to change both their names after learning more about 16th century theologian Martin Luther, who was one of the key figures of the Protestant Reformation. Inspired by that battle, Michael King soon began referring to himself and his son as Martin Luther King. Using the prefix Dr. to refer to King has become a reflex, but not everyone is aware of the origin of King's PhD. He attended Boston University and graduated in 1955 with a doctorate in systematic theology. King also had a Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology from Morehouse College and a Bachelor of Divinity from Crozier Theological Seminary. Opponents tried to silence King, a powerful voice for an ignored and suppressed minority, the old-fashioned way, incarceration. In the 12 years he spent as the recognized leader of the civil rights movement, King was arrested and jailed 30 times. Rather than brood, King used the unsolicited downtime to further his cause. Jailed in Birmingham for 8 days in 1963, he penned Letter from the Birmingham Jail, a long treatise responding to the oppression supported by white religious leaders in the South. "I'm afraid that it is much too long to take your precious time," he wrote. "I can assure you that it would have been much shorter if I had been writing from a comfortable desk. But what else is there to do when you are alone for days in the dull monotony of a narrow jail cell, other than write long letters, think strange thoughts, and pray long prayers?" King's increasing prominence and influence agitated many of his enemies, but few were more powerful than FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. For years, Hoover kept King under surveillance, worried that he could sway public opinion against the Bureau and fretting that King might have communist ties. An anonymous letter, likely written by Hoover's deputy, William Sullivan, who may or may not have been acting on Hoover's orders, was sent to King in 1964, accusing him of extramarital affairs and threatening to disclose his indiscretions. The only solution, the letter suggested, would be for King to exit the civil rights movement either willingly or by dying by suicide. King ignored the threat and continued his work. Our collective memory of King always has an unfortunate addendum, his 1968 assassination that brought an end to his personal crusade against social injustice. But if Isola Ware Curry had had her way, King's mission would have ended 10 years earlier. At a Harlem book signing in 1958, Curry approached King and plunged a 7-inch letter opener into his chest, nearly puncturing his aorta. Surgery was needed to remove it. Had King so much as sneezed, doctors said, the wound was so close to his heart that it would have been fatal. Curry, a 42-year-old black woman, was having paranoid delusions about the NAACP that soon crystallized around King. She was committed to an institution and died in 2015. King's promise as one of the greatest orators of all time was late to emerge. While attending Crozier Theological Seminary from 1948 to 1951, King's marks were diluted by C and C-plus grades in 2 terms of public speaking. At the 13th Annual Grammy Awards in 1971, a recording of King's 1967 address, "Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam," took home a posthumous award for Best Spoken Word Recording. In 2012, his 1963 "I Have a Dream" speech was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. It was included decades later because its 1969 nomination was beaten for the Spoken Word Prize by Rod McEwen's "Lonesome Cities." It's not easy to imagine King having the time or inclination to sit down and watch primetime science fiction on television. But according to actress Nichelle Nichols, King and his family made an exception for Star Trek. In 1967, the actress met King, who told her he was a big fan and urged her to reconsider her decision to leave the show to perform on Broadway. "My family are your greatest fans," Nichols recalled King telling her, and said he continued with, "As a matter of fact, This is the only show on television that my wife Coretta and I will allow our little children to watch, to stay up and watch because it's past their bedtime. Nichols' character, Lieutenant Uhura, he said, was important because she was a strong professional black woman. If Nichols left, King noted, the character could be replaced by anyone since Uhura is not a black role, and it's not a female role. Based on their talk, Nichols decided to remain on the show for the duration of its 3-season original run. When King married his wife Coretta Scott in her father's backyard in 1953, there was virtually no hotel in Marion, Alabama that would welcome a newlywed black couple. A friend of Coretta's happened to be an undertaker and invited the Kings to stay at one of the guest rooms at his funeral parlor. Despite King's worthiness, Martin Luther King Day was not a foregone conclusion. In the early 1980s, President Ronald Reagan largely ignored pleas to pass legislation making the holiday official out of the concern it would open the door for other underrepresented groups to demand their own holidays. Senator Jesse Helms, Republican of North Carolina, complained that the missed workday would cost the country $12 billion in lost productivity, and both were worried about King's possible communist sympathies. Common sense prevailed, and the bill was signed into law on November 2, 1983. The holiday officially began being recognized in January 1986. In 2016, the U.S. Treasury announced plans to overhaul major denominations of currency beginning in 2020. Along with Harriet Tubman adorning the $20 bill, the plan called for the reverse side of the $5 Lincoln stamp bill to commemorate historic events that occurred at the Lincoln Memorial, including King's famous 1963 speech. In April 2018, though, the Trump administration announced that those plans were on hold and the bills would be delayed by at least 6 years. King's 1963 oration from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, known as the I Have a Dream speech, will always be remembered as one of the most provocative public addresses ever given. George Raveling, who was 26 at the time, had volunteered to help King and his team during the event. When it was over, Raveling sheepishly asked King for the copy of the 3-page speech. King handed it over without hesitation. Raveling kept it for the next 20 years before he fully understood its historical significance and removed it from the book he had been storing it in. He turned down offers of up to $3.5 million, insisting that the document will remain in his family, always noting that the most famous passage, where King details his dream of a united nation, isn't on the sheets. It was improvised. That was the article, 12 Historic Facts About Martin Luther King Jr. It was written by Jake Rosin and published January 2, 2026 at the website mentalfloss.com. My next reading is titled, The Long and Unrelenting Battle to Establish Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This was written by Terry Tang and published January 5, 2026 in the Independent newspaper. The idea to establish a national holiday for the civil rights icon arose as the nation was plunged into grief. U.S. Democratic Republican John Conyers of Michigan, one of the longest-serving members of Congress known for his liberal stance on civil rights, proposed legislation to recognize King 4 days after his assassination outside a motel in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4, 1968. Supporters knew it would not be easy. King, who was 39 years old at the time, was a polarizing figure to half the country even before his death, said Lerone Martin, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. Polls conducted by the Washington Post and the New York Times indicated most Americans did not trust King or thought he was too radical because of his speeches on poverty, housing, and against the Vietnam War. People say that King is moving too fast after 1965 and basically, hey, you got the voting rights bill done. That's enough, Martin said. the Congressional Black Caucus, founded by Conyers, tried to bring the legislation up for a vote for the next 15 years. Among the Republican rebuttals, public holidays don't apply to private citizens, King was a communist, or King was a womanizer. In the meantime, his widow, Coretta Scott King, kept lobbying for it. Musician Stevie Wonder even released a song, Happy Birthday, to rally support. So what changed? In the 1980s, the social and cultural climate of the United States had shifted, and the public was reflecting on racial progress, Martin said. Most Americans now were also regretting the Vietnam War. Supporters, meanwhile, were still calling for federal holiday status. In 1983, about 20 years after King's I Have a Dream speech, legislation for a Martin Luther King Jr. Day on the third Monday of January cleared Congress, and President Ronald Reagan signed it. Reagan's signing did not lead other Republicans to follow. It would be 17 more years until all 50 states observed it. Most of the foot-dragging came from the South, except for Arizona. Then in 1987, Governor Evan Meacham rescinded his predecessor's executive order enacting a state holiday in Arizona. He said, "Black people don't need a holiday. Y'all need jobs," recalled Dr. Warren H. Stewart, Sr., pastor at the First Institutional Baptist Church in Phoenix. That started the war. Stewart launched a group to lead people of all colors and all persuasions, faiths, and parties in protest marches. Entertainers, including Wonder, canceled Arizona events. Companies moved conventions. The tipping point was the loss of hosting the Super Bowl. In 1992, Arizona became the first state where voter initiative reinstated the King holiday. Supporters took a victory lap the next MLK Day with a packed arena concert attended by Wonder and other artists. Even Rosa Parks was there. Stewart remembers speaking to the crowd. "What I said there, and it still applies today, we've won the holiday, but the holiday is a symbol of liberty and justice for all, and we must move from symbol to substance," he said. South Carolina was the final holdout until 2000, but it was without the backing of the civil rights groups because it also allowed for a Confederate Memorial Day. Martin Luther King Day's reach has only grown in its 42 years. It's the only federal holiday where you take a day on, not a day off. In 1994, President Bill Clinton signed into law Congressman John Lewis and Senator Harris Wolfert's legislation, making it a national day of service. Just about every major city and suburb has some revelry the weekend before, including parades, street festivals, and concerts. The various service projects run the gamut: community cleanup, packing food boxes, donating blood. AmeriCorps, the federal agency that deploys volunteers to serve communities around the nation, has distributed $1.5 million in grants to 200 nonprofits, faith-based groups, and other organizations for projects. CEO Michael Smith estimates there have been hundreds of projects involving hundreds of thousands of people for MLK Day in recent years. Engagement seems to be expanding. "You know, any given day I see another project that has nothing to do with us," said Smith, who has served in President Joe Biden's administration. "What's so important about the King holiday is not only the service that's going to happen, but how it creates a spark for people to think about how maybe they're going to serve all year long." That's something King's daughter, the Reverend Bernice King and CEO of the King Center in Atlanta, desires as well. She wishes people would do more than quote King, which we love to do. They need to do good work and commit daily to embrace the spirit of nonviolence. Martin also thinks it's important to learn about the man himself. He finds excitement in seeing people read or hear about the Nobel Peace Prize winner, but nothing compares to taking in King's own writings, such as his 1963 Letter from the Birmingham Jail, he noted. "We can arm ourselves with his ideals," Martin said. "We can continue to have a conversation with him, not just on one day, but actually throughout the year." That article was titled, The Long and Unrelenting Battle to Establish Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It was written by Terry Tang and published January 5, 2026, in the British newspaper The Independent at its website, independent.co.uk. My next reading on today's African American Hour is an opinion piece. The title is, Why the Struggle for a Third Reconstruction Remains the Struggle for Our Times. This was written by Peniel Joseph and published November 3, 2025 at the website nonprofitquarterly.org. And as a note, the author, Peniel Joseph, is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, where he serves as founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. He is also Distinguished Service Leadership Professor and Professor of History at UT Austin's College of Liberal Arts. Since 1865 and the end of a cataclysmic civil war in which an estimated 698,000 Americans perished, the United States has been locked in a narrative war between Reconstructionists and Redemptionists, those who wanted to build a multiracial democracy and those who wanted to redeem or restore white rule. U.S. Reconstruction represented an experiment in multiracial democracy, the first of its kind. Since the Civil War, U.S. history has waxed and waned between the two competing visions of the Republic's future. Despite setbacks, betrayals, and shortcomings, advocates of multiracial democracy remain steadfast in their pursuit of racial justice and human dignity for all people in the United States, even as opponents have relentlessly attacked this vision through legislation, policy, and legal means, as well as violence, disinformation, and outright lies. Today's struggle for a third Reconstruction speaks to this long, ongoing conflict. The next part of the article is titled, The Post-Civil War Rebirth of the United States. Reconstruction represents a second founding of the United States, an effort to confront the nation's original sin of racial slavery and institutionalize black citizenship for previously enslaved African Americans who, even in captivity, forged a deep love for a country not yet in existence, but one they vowed to make a reality. Racial slavery's end marked the creation of a new U.S. republic where expansive notions of citizenship became consecrated in constitutional amendments. Families were reunited and historically black colleges and universities were founded. At the same time, one-room schoolhouses sprang up as markers of educational aspiration, and churches supported spiritual and political renewal of lost, hungry, and ambitious souls in search of opportunities to lead lives of dignity and full citizenship. The period between the 1865 passage of the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery, and the white-led racial massacre in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898 represents the first Reconstruction in U.S. history, a time of vastly expanded opportunities for the 4 million black Americans who struggled and won their freedom through service as soldiers, civil rights activists, abolitionists, and self-emancipated contrabands who fled southern plantations as Union troops, including the United States Colored Troops beginning in 1863, descended upon the Confederacy. Black Americans at the local, state, and national levels assumed elected office in states that once held them in bondage. They sought to expand multiracial democracy, fund public schools and works projects, and reimagine freedom, citizenship, dignity, and democracy. These Americans, alongside white allies in Congress, the Republican Party, and ordinary citizens, were Reconstructionists. They were supporters in word and deed of multiracial democracy and of a republic whose ideas of freedom surpassed the philosophical intent of the nation's founders. An unapologetic movement of white supremacy at first hunted, then overwhelmed Reconstructionist advocates. In 1866, the same year Fisk University, which would claim the scholar activist W.E.B. Du Bois as its most eminent graduate, was founded in Nashville, Tennessee, the Ku Klux Klan emerged 70 miles to the south in Pulaski, Tennessee. Racist violence in the South violated the physical safety of Black Americans. The passage of the Black Codes curtailed the movement of the newly freed Black populace. The Grandfather Clause circumvented voting rights, and the institutionalization of systems of sharecropping and peonage forced Black labor into a mean season of servitude. The advent of the convict leasing system that racially profiled, criminalized, and incarcerated Black people during Reconstruction inaugurated a system of carceral punishment that continues well into the 21st century. The advocates of white supremacy and anti-Black racism, who came to political power through violence, legislative and legal means, and the corruption of political institutions, vowed to redeem the South from the alleged scourges of Black citizenship and multiracial democracy. Redemptionists lost the Civil War, but through extra-legal violence and bad faith political maneuvers, they won the peace. The new political order of Jim Crow segregation that they advocated was portrayed as the happy result of white manhood defending traditional Christian and familial values. From this perspective, lynching was seen as a heroic act in defense of kith and kin. Segregation was asserted to be the natural biological and cultural separation of races, which represented distinct kinds of human beings. Most importantly, these anti-democratic forces of white supremacy won the narrative war. Reconstruction's end opened the dam of white retribution with a vengeance and violence that remains almost unfathomable, peaking with dozens of racist pogroms that even reached Black people who had previously fled the South for the supposed safety of the North. Atlanta, 1906. Springfield, Illinois, 1908. Elaine, Arkansas, 1919. Chicago, 1919. Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1921. And Rosewood, Florida, 1923. The next part of the article is titled, A Second Reconstruction. Brutal repression and political violence were not the end of the story, however. A long civil rights movement began to emerge nationally and in the South during the New Deal period of the 1930s, leading to a renewed movement in the United States for multiracial democracy. The high point of the nation's second Reconstruction unfolded between the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education U.S. Supreme Court decision that declared separate but equal schools and the cruel society this doctrine sanctioned unconstitutional, and the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. These years comprise the civil rights movement's heroic period, an epoch where sharecroppers, laborers, preachers, and students, two generations removed from slavery and still in the throes of lynching and gruesome racial violence, led a movement for radical democracy that transformed the nation. From the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 to 1956, to the Little Rock Central High School confrontation of 1957, to the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, in the wake of lunch counter sit-ins protesting segregated restaurants, that movement for Black dignity and citizenship helped to ignite a national movement for Reconstruction. However, resistance was fierce, with some characterizing it as a second domestic civil war. A veritable rogues gallery of Southern governors, from Mississippi's Ross Barnett to Alabama's George Wallace, rose to national infamy through their defense of white supremacy that made them political heroes to racists across the nation. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom drew a quarter of a million Americans in support of multiracial democracy on August 28, 1963. King's I Have a Dream speech distilled the moral and political framework for reimagining democracy as a collective endeavor. We rightfully commemorate the watershed legislation that followed that march, namely the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Yet, the most important part of the nation's second Reconstruction is less discussed. Reconstructionists, for the first time in U.S. history, won the narrative war over the meaning of citizenship and dignity, freedom, and multiracial democracy. They argued successfully that racial justice must be the beating heart of a reimagined democracy. Perhaps none did it as eloquently as writer James Baldwin, whose best-selling book of essays, The Fire Next Time, released in January 1963, distilled the arbitrary results of redemptionists having betrayed the promise of the Second Republic created in the aftermath of a bloody civil war. What President John F. Kennedy characterized during a June 11, 1963 televised civil rights address as the fires of frustration and discord proved to be a revolution. The assassinations of Mississippi NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers the following day, of four black girls and two boys, Johnny Robinson and Virgil Ware, in Birmingham on September 15th, and most shockingly, President Kennedy on November 22nd, became the crucible through which the nation allowed itself to be remade. These iconic martyrs, alongside countless others, ushered in a 50-year racial justice consensus that ended with the Supreme Court's 2013 5-4 decision in Shelby County v. Holder, eliminating Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and ushering in a backlash against Reconstructionist policies that continues to grow. The next section of this opinion piece is titled, A New Backlash. From a certain perspective, the 2008 presidential election of Barack Obama signaled the outlines of a third effort at Reconstruction, alongside Black Lives Matter's emergence in 2013 and the racial and political reckoning of 2020 in the aftermath of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. For a time, it seemed as if a new era of racial justice, reconciliation, and multiracial democracy might take hold. Diversity, equity, and inclusion became part of the national discourse on race during a year when an estimated 15 to 26 million Americans hit the street to protest racial injustice and police brutality and demand institutions that could help unleash the potential of multiracial democracy. The January 6, 2021 assault on the nation's capital proved emblematic of the redemptionist efforts to quash multiracial democracy and black citizenship and dignity in tandem. The violent push to overturn the lawful election of Joseph Biden to the White House, an effort supported by the defeated incumbent Donald Trump, has, since the shameful day, been successfully reimagined by the right wing of this nation as a lawful assemblage of patriots who were brutalized by law enforcement, the exact opposite of the truth and the facts of that day. Even before the second Trump presidency, the backlash to efforts at repairing centuries of racial injustice and anti-democratic systems had begun at the level of the ongoing narrative war. Conservative bloggers targeted the 1619 Project, diversity, equity, and inclusion, critical race theory, and black history as part of a left-wing ideology of wokeness designed to destroy children, hurt white people, and allow unqualified minorities to get jobs that they neither earned nor deserved. The final section of this opinion piece is titled, The Road Ahead. A third Reconstruction begins with forging a new racial justice consensus grounded in mutual respect for human life and a shared concept of dignity. Either everyone counts or none of us do. Dignity is what each human soul carries within them. During this time of racist backlash, censorship, fear-mongering, hatred, and rising authoritarianism, advocates must stand firm on the shoulders of those who face even more daunting odds in the past, and on the principles that King characterized as a beloved community. King defined the beloved community as more than civil and voting rights. He articulated a conception of radical citizenship that included a living wage, decent housing, health care, quality education, and the freedom to live in peace, which required an end to conflict zones in the United States and abroad. A Reconstructionist vision of the United States needs a full-throated embrace of voting rights, defending black lives and people of color, and opposing anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and anti-immigrant sentiment that undergirds the current shameful and violent backlash. In retrospect, the half-century racial justice consensus forged in the crucible of the civil rights movement domestically and the anti-colonial freedom surge internationally, attest to the strengths of long-standing institutions, just as its demise today illustrates the shattering vulnerabilities of those same structures. Yes, there is a tangible reason for hope. There are, mercifully, tens of millions of people in the United States who vehemently disagree with the nation's current direction. The task ahead is not simply to reverse the catastrophic political tides of the present, but to ennoble the country and begin a new era of national renewal centered on the pursuit of inclusive multiracial democracy. This requires multiracial and multi-issue political coalitions rooted in local organizing that connect the daily struggles of ordinary people, including those living in red states, to the hopes and dreams, as well as the political and economic challenges, of those residing in seemingly politically shielded blue states. Recognizing that what troubles one of us impacts us all follows in the spirit of King, who famously reminded us that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Our dreams of freedom require bold thinking, personal courage, and hearts big enough to understand that beyond this current moment of heartbreak lies an undiscovered country of human dignity that allows us to finally fulfill that long-delayed, but no longer denied, promise of multiracial democracy. That was the opinion piece titled, Why the Struggle for a Third Reconstruction Remains the Struggle of Our Times. This was written by Peniel Joseph and published November 3, 2025 at the website nonprofitquarterly.org. This year, Martin Luther King's birthday is the 15th of January, and the holiday for him falls on January 19th. In honor of that, I'm going to read an excerpt from the most recent biography of Martin Luther King Jr., titled King a Life, written by Jonathan Eich. This was the winner of the 2024 Pulitzer Prize for Biography. I'll be reading an excerpt from the first chapter titled The Kings of Stockbridge, which is about Martin Luther King Jr.'s grandparents. And I found this at the website of Macmillan Publishers and us.macmillan.com. There is language in this excerpt that will offend some listeners. Chapter 1, The Kings of Stockbridge. Take this bucket of milk to the neighbors, Delia King told her son Michael one day. Delia and her husband, Jim King, lived with their growing brood of children in a tiny wooden sharecropper shack in Stockbridge, Georgia, about 20 miles southeast of Atlanta. The shack and the land around it belonged to a white man. The white man kept most of the money from the crops, but it was the King family, one generation removed from slavery, that cleared the soil stone by stone, planted and picked the cotton, and went hungry when the scorching sun rendered the earth no more fertile than a rutted road. Yet, when Delia heard that her neighbor had a sick cow that wouldn't give milk, she acted without hesitation. She was a very devout Christian, recalled Michael, who would go on to change his name to Martin Luther King Sr. I remember as a small boy, my mother was a woman who shared what she had with others, he said, in a newly discovered set of audio tape interviews he made for an unpublished autobiography. Michael was about 12 years old when his mother sent him on his mission that bright summer day around 1910. As he carried his bucket, he paused in front of a sawmill where he watched burly men and oxen at work, hauling timber. A voice snapped him to attention. It was the white mill owner. Say, boy, run get a bucket of water for my men from down at the stream. Apologizing, Michael told the mill owner he was on an errand. He needed to go. The mill owner grabbed Michael by his shirt and kicked over his bucket of milk. As Michael bent to pick up the bucket, the white man's boot connected with the boy's ear. He tumbled. He tried to rise, but a fist smashed his face. Blood poured from his mouth. Everything went hazy. Michael got up. ran home and spotted his mother in the yard, washing clothes in an iron tub set over a fire. Delia scanned her son's blood-crusted face and torn shirt. "Who did this to you, Michael?" she asked, voice low and tight. The boy didn't answer. "Michael," Delia screamed, "who did this?" Delia marched to the mill, squeezing her son's wrist as she tugged him along. She found the owner. "Did you do this to my child?" She locked eyes with the man. "Woman, you lost your mind? Get the hell out of here before I..." Delia screamed, "Did you do this to my child?" "Yeah." She lowered her shoulder and rammed the mill owner in his chest, knocking him into the side of a shed. She forced him to the ground and hammered at his face with hands and arms hardened by a lifetime of manual labor. When one of the mill workers tried to pull her away, Delia punched him too. The others backed off. "You can kill me, but if you put a hand on a child of mine, you'll answer." Delia balled her fist, ready for more, but the mill owner wanted none of it. Back home, Delia cleaned her son's face. She warned him not to tell his father what had happened. A black woman might get away with beating a white man, but a black man would likely pay with his life. Soon, though, Jim King heard about the mill owner's attack on his son. As Delia had feared, Jim grabbed a rifle and went to the mill bent on revenge. The owner wasn't there. That night, a mob of white men on horseback rode to the King's shack. Jim King knew the law offered no protection, so he did the only thing he could think of to save himself and his family. He ran. He took off into the woods and stayed away through the summer and into the fall. Delia became sick. The cotton crop suffered and the vegetables got picked too late. The family struggled to survive the winter. Months later, Michael heard from a friend that the mill owner was no longer angry. Things could go back to normal, the friend said. Jim King came home, but normal was not an option. "I'm gonna blow one of these crackers' heads off," he told his son. Jim drank heavily and argued forcefully with Delia. When he left the house, he went alone and took his rifle. He tried to shoot something his family could eat, but he was often too drunk to see a rabbit, much less hit one. "I just wondered what normal was for us," Michael recalled, "and how long we could expect it to last." Michael King's parents were born in the so-called Reconstruction years immediately following the Civil War. Men and women recently released from slavery purchased land, started churches, and built communities. They voted, too, electing more than 2,000 black public officials, including a governor in Louisiana, 10 black members of the U.S. House of Representatives, and 2 U.S. senators. The historian Eric Foner described Reconstruction as a radical experiment in interracial democracy, during which formerly enslaved laborers became free laborers. But the experiment failed. As W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again toward slavery." The white backlash to black people's gains was immediate and vicious. The U.S. government permitted white elected officials in the South to address the so-called Negro problem as they liked. Racial animosity metastasized. A system of land rental known as sharecropping forced black farmers into a relationship with white landowners that was deeply exploitative. Factory owners and financiers in the North went along for the most part, silenced by the profits generated by cheap labor. White officials in the South concluded that black people were not only inferior and therefore unfit to be treated as equal citizens, but also a threat to their physical safety. Southern lawmakers passed codes to establish systems of peonage not far removed from slavery. By the start of the 20th century, every state in the South had laws designed to divide the races and subordinate black people. The segregation rules, commonly known as Jim Crow laws, mandated separation of the races. In schools, trains, theaters, churches, hotels, hospitals, barbershops, restrooms, orphanages, prisons, funeral homes, cemeteries, and elsewhere. Jim Crow laws prohibited black and white people from playing checkers, dominoes, and card games together in their own homes. Marriage between races was forbidden, too. For many in the white community, the greatest fear of all was miscegenation, which would blur the line they had worked so hard to create and enforce. For others, the greatest fear was a reordering of power. Supporters viewed the Jim Crow laws as a system of controls, like dams and dikes, designed to preserve the natural order as they perceived it. In 1896, the U.S. Supreme Court gave legal sanction to segregation in Plessy v. Ferguson, creating a standard of separate but equal that was anything but equal. Atlanta became the unofficial capital of the booming divided South. It was in Atlanta in 1895 that the black educator Booker T. Washington proposed his famous compromise, saying black people would at least for the upcoming future accept separation of the races if the white community in return took responsibility for improving the skills and social conditions of black people. But Washington's critics feared that such a compromise would leave black people permanently subservient. Georgia, as W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in 1903, became the center of the Negro problem, the center of those 9 million men who are America's dark heritage from slavery and the slave trade. Jim King, born the year after the abolition of chattel slavery, personified the crushing frustrations of black life in the South. He never learned to read or write. He never voted. He never owned property. Instead, he lived in a perpetual state of debt to the white men for whom he farmed. He grew lean, edgy, and angry. America hadn't given Jim King much. And then, bit by bit, it took away what little he had managed to accumulate, leaving frustration, travail, and rage. That's how his son Michael described it. The American dream, built on promises written into the nation's founding documents, lost all meaning. Jim King drank until he had a look of very quiet but very serious fire in his eyes, wrote his son, until he no longer cared. Not about living, not about pain, not about his anger or anything else. Delia, 10 years younger than her husband, held the family together. Born Delia Lindsay in Ellenwood, Georgia, she too had grown up on a white-owned farm. Her father, Jim Long, had been used in slavery to sire children, to build up the owner's supply of enslaved laborers and boost the owner's return on investment in human property. Enslaved women were the victims of these forced sexual encounters. Delia's mother, Jane Lindsay, born in 1853, gave birth to her first child at the age of 16 and went on to have 4 more without marrying. In 1880, the federal census reported that Jane was 27. The mother of 5, single, not widowed or divorced, with no occupation other than keeping home. Jim Long appears on the next page of the census, living nearby at the age of 36, married to a woman named Frances with 10 more children. Delia Lindsay, L-I-N-S-E-Y, married Jim King in Henry County on August 20, 1895. On the marriage license, Delia's maiden name was spelled Lindsay, L-I-N-D-S-E-Y. 5 years later, the Kings were living in Ellenwood, Georgia, where Jim worked as a day laborer and Delia took care of their daughter, Woody, and their son, Michael. Another son, Lucius, died at some point during infancy. In addition to farming, Jim King worked part-time at a rock quarry until an accident in the quarry took one of his fingers and made further work there impossible. By 1910, the Kings were farming cotton in Stockbridge and raising 7 children. Federal census reports show that Delia King didn't know how to read or write in 1900 or 1910. But by 1920, at age 45, she had learned, most likely by reading the Bible. When she wasn't giving birth, feeding children, cooking for her family, sewing, washing, planting vegetables, or picking cotton, Delia cleaned and ironed clothes for white families. When it rained, the roof leaked. When ice-cold wind blew through the cracks in the flimsy walls, the family crowded around the fireplace, Michael recalled, while our backs shivered. They had no running water and no indoor toilet. But Mama was at peace with herself, Michael wrote, because of her abiding faith. No matter what misfortune befell her, Delia King would never close her eyes so tight in sorrow or rage that she did not see God's hand reaching out to her. Every Sunday, Delia and the children walked to church, carrying their shoes so as not to wear them out. They alternated between Methodist and Baptist churches. Jim King did not attend either one. He didn't care anything about church, Michael recalled. He wouldn't go to church. My daddy would work all week, and at the end of the week, he would get drunk and then scrap with my mother. I got to where I hated Saturdays and Sundays for what my father was going to do and how he was going to act up. But as long as Delia and the children were in church, they were safe from Jim King's anger. Black Baptists outnumbered white Baptists in Georgia. Black culture and black political activism rose from the pews and pulpits of the black church. For many, religion offered release from the pain of ordinary life. Black Baptist preachers frequently imparted the radical message that all people were free and equal under God's laws, that the rules and regulations handed down by white men were wrong, that the racial hierarchies invented by men to justify slavery were false and craven, that the savagery of the Ku Klux Klan and the segregation laws of the South were abominations in the eyes of God, and that God would never love one group of people more than another based on the color of their skin. Prayers and hymns eased Delia King's suffering. They offered hope that her children and grandchildren might live to see a better day. Faith in God also helped create a sense of community. Hog killing time, for example, brought a festive sense of community and a living reminder of the spirit of Jesus' love. As Michael King would recall years later, those who owned animals big enough to slaughter shared meat with those in need, knowing they would be repaid in kind one day. That kind of sharing was, to me, Christianity in action, he said. Martin Luther King Jr., Delia's grandson, would often remark on the role Christianity played in the lives of the enslaved and indentured. The land they farmed was not their own. The crops they planted and sowed were not their own. Their bodies were not entirely their own. But their souls, he said, would never belong to a plantation owner, a landlord, a hooded Klansman, a prison warden, a sheriff, a senator, or anybody else. Their souls would always be free. So many things stood there to discourage them, Martin Luther King Jr. said. But the old preacher would come up with his broken language. He would look down at them and said, "Friends, you ain't no nigger. You ain't no slave. But you God's children." They were not educated, King said. But they knew God. They knew that the God they worship would not punish some of his children and exalt others. And so, he continued, although they knew that some days they had to go out into the field in their bare feet, that didn't stop them. And they would sing in their broken language. "I got shoes, you got shoes, all of God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, gonna put on my shoes and just walk all over God's heaven." Much of King's family's history can't be traced before the Civil War. Owners prevented the enslaved from learning to read and write. Births and deaths often went unrecorded. Tax collectors and census takers treated black people as property, their names not worth noting. In the first census after the Civil War, taken in 1870, Jim King appears to be recorded as a 5-year-old named James Branham of Eatonton, Georgia, in Putnam County. Jim's age and the ages of his parents, listed as Nathan and Melinda Branham, matched the ages of King's ancestors, suggesting perhaps that the family chose to drop the Branham name, which was a vestige of enslavement, and became King's in freedom. Tax records show that Jim and Delia King worked on a farm owned by a white man named William B. Martin, on land in Stockbridge, partially occupied today by a Walmart supercenter. Michael King, father of Martin Luther King Jr., was born in 1897, the second child of Jim and Delia. My mother was way over on the Indian side, and my father was a mixture of Negro, Irish, and Indian, he once said. I never knew where my father was born or who his parents were. Jim and Delia eventually had 10 children. They heated water for bathing and cooking on a two-eyed kitchen stove and made their underclothes from flour sacks, as Michael later recalled. The demands of farm work, combined with impoverished schools, meant the children went to school 2 or 3 months a year in poorly equipped rural, one-room schools manned by semi-literate teachers only slightly better prepared than the children entrusted to them, he wrote. No amount of labor would make tenant farming profitable for the Kings. After Delia's attack on the mill owner and Jim's flight from the white mob, the family never again felt secure, Michael recalled. Jim King's drinking destabilized everything. He forgot things he was supposed to do, his son wrote, broke up tools when he got mad and stayed away from the little shack we had moved into. He'd be gone for days at a time. When he came back, he'd be yelling and ordering everybody around with threats. One day he came home full of whiskey, his eyes half shut, jaw slackened. As the children watched, Jim slapped Delia in the face. "Don't you hit my mama," Michael said, as he wrestled his father to the floor in his mother's defense. "I'll kill you," the father screamed at his son. "I'll do it, damn you." Michael took the threat seriously and fled to the woods. But he didn't disappear for long, and he didn't turn to alcohol or violence. He turned to God. "I needed help," he wrote, "and at least I knew that." He prayed and went home. Soon after, while everyone slept, Michael King slipped past his brothers and sisters, snuck out of the house, and headed down the road. He walked barefoot, his shoes slung over his shoulder on a string. The year was 1912. He was 14 years old and bound for Atlanta. That was Chapter 1, The Kings of Stockbridge, from the book titled King: A Life, written by Jonathan Eig, which was the 2024 Pulitzer Prize winner for biography. This excerpt was found at the website of the publishers of the book, Macmillan Publishers, and their us.macmillan.com website. That's all for this week. If you would like to replay this program or listen to past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them in the archives of the Audio Reader Service at the University of Kansas. That website is reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.